Hello and welcome to Cinematic Sevens, a list of seven films on a simple theme. I'm Stephen and I've got with me Alistair and Joe.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for joining me.
No problem.
This episode's theme is country names. Now, as I stipulated before when we did the last episode, I said that people couldn't use America because that is the name of a continent rather than an actual country.
Two continents, actually.
It is.
It's going to be really finicky.
Which I could be, but I'll let you do that
bit.
Not
really.
So, I shall kick this one off with Big Trouble in Little China, okay. Which is a film that has a certain amount of a cult following from 1986 and directed by John Carpenter, starring Kurt Russell, Kim Cattrall and a number of other notable faces such as James Hong and Victor Wong, who were a certain part of the 80s were the go-to guys for
recognisable
faces.
And Chinese faces. Mr. Chinaman number one and Mr. Chinaman number two.
Absolutely. So, it's a piece of 80s action ridiculousness, really, that has a cult following. It's got many failings as a film in the fact that it's just stupid in so many ways.
It's one of the worst films I've ever seen.
Oh, wow. Divided opinion.
It was horrendous. It was a car crash happening before my eyes.
Car crash.
I wasn't allowed to close my eyes and not watch it either.
No.
I was made to watch it.
Oh, dear.
You were forced with matchsticks under your eyelids to watch it.
It was absolutely awful.
I think the thing is that if you see this film when you are a younger age and especially more impressionable, you see the fun element in it and you see it as just being ridiculous and joyous, and you don't see it for its
failings, as
its
it were.
Failings as a piece of
cinema
in the same way as, you know, Hitchcock and all these kinds of things. It's not well made, it's ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. But it's, in my opinion and a number of other people's opinions, it is just great fun despite being so bad.
They're the kind of films that do have the cult following, though, aren't they? You know,
they
don't tend to be the best made films or the best written or best acted. They're just.
And the ones
best
that,
acted?
Oh, the acting. Some of the acting
oh,
is.
Oh, my word.
I mean, it's got Kim Cattrall in it.
And her brother was Pinocchio.
She was so wooden. It was amazing some of the way that she was delivering lines was.
Most of the time she had wide eyes, like she was caught in the headlights.
Absolutely. She was reading it off a piece of paper that was stuck on the bottom of the camera. I mean, granted, a lot of the dialogue was difficult to deliver in a way, but she couldn't even deliver simple bits of dialogue without it just sounding terrible. On the acting side of it, it's not well acted at all. It is.
And didn't we spot, as the film went on, other films within the film? I kept seeing, I'm sure they weren't meant to be there, but I kept seeing other films. I saw Bill and Ted in the lift.
Oh, there's elements of
the
of
Three Amigos when the three Chinese guys came down.
You were movie spotting, which was noting similarities. There weren't conscious similarities, but there were things that you could point out sometimes as tropes.
Some
and
fun
sometimes
in, even in a movie you can't stand, I suppose.
Yeah. I suppose so. Yeah, but I do think it's a great piece of fun, to be honest. I mean, I can understand that is very much because it is something that I experienced when I was young, and it's remained with you in that element. You've got a fondness for a place that it occupied in that sense, and it's like a number of things. I mean, if you watch The Goonies now, you won't necessarily enjoy it. If you come to it brand new, I think you would see a certain number of flaws with The Goonies, even though it is a lot better made than Big Trouble in Little China, obviously.
Oh, wow. That's saying something.
Their clothes would have got dirty, whereas Kurt Russell's vest.
Kurt Russell
never,
had the
John McClane of vests.
Ever clean vest.
It was never dirty, matter what he did.
There you go. Look at the legacy he gave the world then with John McClane as a character in that sense.
Sponsored by
Death. So, divided opinion about the film, but nonetheless.
Yes.
Stephen, you'd recommend people go see it?
I recommend it because it's ridiculous.
Yeah, go see it,
you know,
for a laugh.
Don't go to it expecting a great piece of filmmaking.
Right.
So, if we can have your first one, Alistair, that would be
right, my first one is going to be a little British B-movie called Dead in France.
Right.
I suppose it's another film like Big Trouble in Little China, in that it's not particularly well made, but it's fun. I enjoyed it. It's a kind of crime comedy kind of film. It's got its tongue in its cheek. It knows it's not the best film ever made, but it deals with a hitman, Charles, and his sort of moral dilemma with wanting to give up the assassination business that he's been in for most of his life. As I say, a bit of a B-movie. Doesn't really star anyone you'll have seen or be aware of, but personally I enjoyed it. Directed by Chris McManus.
Right-o.
By and large, panned, from what I can gather.
When was it made?
It was made 2012, so...
Fairly recent.
Fairly recent.
In terms of the films that we're currently talking about, I think.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah.
It's definitely more recent.
And as I say, it's not the best shot film ever made. It's not the best acted or the best written, but I enjoyed it because it was fun. It didn't take itself too seriously, and in its own certain way, and I've poked fun at the kind of gangster crime-ish, Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels-ish type of British cinema. So
it's a British film, is it?
Yeah, British film.
So, yeah, despite the name France in it, it's a British film, huh? Yes, I've not heard of it, I have to confess. It's a brand new one on me in that sense.
It's one of those that slips under the radar, I think, but not surprisingly, but nonetheless.
You'd recommend some people see it?
I mean, I don't regret having seen it, I'll put it that way. It was an hour and a half.
What was going on in your life at the time? Was there something?
Touché. I don't regret having seen it. As I say, I found it fun and enjoyable. If you go into it expecting a serious film, you won't enjoy it. A bit like Little Trouble. Big Trouble, Little China.
Yes. Well, hopefully Dead in France at least isn't one that's going to be getting remade with The Rock in it.
True.
Unfortunately, that's happening to Big Trouble in Little China.
Oh, wow. It'll be even better then, won't it?
Need a considerably bigger vest as well, won't they?
Well, it'll be very big.
Kurt Russell was quite muscly in it.
Mm.
The Rock will need
He certainly have a lot more trouble squeezing through some of the small gaps in.
Yeah, he might get his dirty.
Yeah. So, what's your first one then, Joe?
Salmon fishing in the Yemen. Made in 2011, and the title made me not want to watch it. because salmon fishing doesn't interest me, and I've never been to the Yemen. I've been very close. I've been to Oman.
Not Yemen. But yeah, even then you didn't go there for fishing, did you?
No, there was no fishing involved.
Unsurprisingly, really.
I did read the book first, and one of the reasons why I thought twice about watching the film is because most films that are done based on the book, they are very thinly based on the book, whereas this really stuck to the plot, and the characters all remain the same. There was no Hollywood any of the characters.
Right, that's good.
McGregor played Dr. Jones, who's a fisheries expert.
Jones. I had to do it.
You call him Dr. Jones, lady.
He's a fisheries expert who gets seconded to a project that a sheikh wants to bring salmon fishing to a wadi in the Yemen.
Right.
And he's approached by the aide of this sheikh, played by Emily Blunt. And it's the process that they go through from start to finish. He doesn't want to be anything to do with the project to start with, but as it goes along, he can see the merits of it, and he meets the sheikh.
It's a pretty zany idea, isn't it, really? Bringing salmon fishing to the middle of the desert.
Yeah, and that's how he first thought of the idea, to be honest. It's a very sweet and gentle film, and it never strays from the actual point of the film, which is bringing salmon fishing to the Yemen. There's no unnecessary guns and gore, and I don't think they swear in it either at any point.
Is there no car chase?
Unfortunately not, no. No. There's quite a lot of fish, though.
Is there?
Yeah.
Wow.
Funnily enough.
Shocker.
There's a lot of fish. Kristen Scott Thomas plays the Prime Minister's press secretary in it, and she gets very involved because she wants to use it for the Prime Minister's sort of election campaign, and she's hilarious.
Well, she's a very good actress, and I think she can do drama and do the subtle comedy.
Mm.
And Emily Blunt, I have a good opinion of as an actress, and Hugh McGregor, when he's given the right material to work with, he's good as well, in my opinion.
I think, the only thing about the cast, Hugh McGregor, when I read the book, you get a picture of how you see certain characters in your head, and he didn't fit. Right. Everybody else fitted, he didn't
within
fit.
Within the film, how he played it, did the role work for him, though? Or did you just struggle through watching the whole thing to see him as the character?
I did a little bit, because a fisheries expert, you don't expect to look like Ewan McGregor.
Is it because he's Scottish?
Nothing to do with him being Scottish. Nothing against the Scottishists. No, he's far too good looking to be a fisheries expert.
Right. Well, apologies to any fishing experts out there.
Or Scottish people.
We don't want to...
No, I'm not offending the Scottish people at all. But he just... I imagined him to be a lot older. In the book, in my head, he was a lot older.
Do you have anybody in your mind, when you were reading the book, anybody in your mind that you would have thought would have played... played the part better?
Not really, no, but they wore a lot of tweed in my head. They were wearing tweed, and they were had like flat hats and fishing rods tucked under one arm.
Hugh Bonneville, who was in Paddington, is he a bit more along the lines, you know, somebody a bit more...
I don't know.
In that sense.
No, I think he's a bit too posh.
Right.
Probably more of a Yorkshire, sick accent, that sort of thing.
You know, Sean Bean, then.
Because he'd die.
Because he'd die at the end
of it. He'd die, yeah.
He'd be killed by a salmon.
Always.
Get bitten by the shake or something, yeah. No, it's a sweet film, and yes, I enjoyed it very much.
Very good.
Oh, that's good then.
And you'd recommend it? Would you recommend the book?
Well, either, because they were both similar, but I don't know if it's like Stephen's cup of tea. I don't think he would particularly enjoy it, but I might be wrong. That's one you can watch, and you made me sit through Big Trouble in Little China. I'm going to make you sit through that now.
Sounds like a trade-off.
Yep.
Well, it's
no Condor Man, let's put it that way.
It's no Condor. Well, that's more intriguing then.
In that case, it's your turn again, Stephen.
My next film will be Brazil, which is a 1985 film by Terry Gilliam.
Oh, yes.
Starring Jonathan Pryce.
One of his early ones, I believe, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Jonathan Pryce, Tim Grace, Robert De Niro, surprisingly. Ian Holm, Bob Hoskins, Michael Palin, Ian Richardson, Peter Vaughan, Jim Broadbent, and most of the catalogue of other British talent you see in there. This is an Orwellian flight of fantasy about incompetent bureaucracy. Yeah. It really, as you would expect from Terry Gilliam's work, is just an overblown mess in a lot of ways, and playing with a lot of themes about reality and how dystopian the futures can be. Mm. And it's the story of a mistake that happens in a bureaucracy where the wrong person is identified as a terrorist and gets put to death by the administration, and then it turns out there was just a silly mistake on the name.
No.
And there's a bureaucrat that tries to clear this up against the wishes of the bureaucracy, who want to actually just get rid of everybody who actually knows about this mistake. And as this unfolds about him actually trying to play off with the ambitions of his vain status-seeking mother and his own pursuit of this woman that he's seen in a dream, that's all playing out together at the same time and creates quite a chaotic...
I can imagine. I'm struggling to picture plot.
Terry Gilliam, if anybody was going to carry this off, it was going to be him, but it is a complete mess. It's one that I don't imagine will be remade with a rock.
surely not.
What are the chances that he's too busy doing other things? I think it does have greatness in it, even though it can be seen as being a complete mess, because it is chaotic. I can totally accept that. But the character performances in there are just amazing.
Really?
The people who are playing the different parts are...
They're
very good at what they do, and you know, they're obviously caricatures and playing for comic effect, some of them, and a bit over the top and everything. But it really does, you know, show the talent in these people, and Robert De Niro being chucked in there. Well, Jonathan Pryce obviously has been the lead character. He stands out, and Michael Palin as well, and Robert De Niro. Their characters that they play are quite stylized.
Right.
In order to actually be strong enough to overcome the chaos of this actual story, I think.
It is
a flight of fantasy in a number of ways, because it does actually have bits of it that aren't actually set in what is the reality of the film. It shows what the mundane bureaucratic greyness of sort of this Orwellian future is compared to people's flight of fantasy in their imaginations and their dreams.
Right.
It's one that, you know, that is worth checking out at some point, but it is one that you need to be in the right mood for, I think, because it is so mad. I think it's difficult to...
Sounds like something I'd have to concentrate on.
not fall asleep after 10 minutes.
I'm too keen on that
idea. So, Alistair.
Right, movie number two. Let's take a punt at The Last King of Scotland.
Right.
Forrest Whitaker, James McAvoy. Take a few punts at The Last King of Scotland. Yeah, very good. Film by Kevin MacDonald, starring Forrest Whitaker and James McAvoy in the two lead roles.
Both very good actors.
Both very good actors, and they play very well off one another in the film. Forrest Whitaker plays Idi Amin, back in a time when he was...
not a terribly nice guy.
Not a terribly nice guy. No. He was never really a terribly nice guy.
No.
But he believes in the film that he's got some... When he's Scottish blood, or he believes he's got some kind of...
Heritage,
I think. Yeah. And James McAvoy, he gets brought on board as a doctor. Idi Amin sort of takes to this character when he learns he's Scottish. They play off one another when they're on screen together very well. Most of the film time you do see one or the other.
Right,
quite so often both of them on screen at the same time, and they do play very well alongside one another.
Right, so it very much hinges the film upon them two as actors, which isn't, you know, considering the strength of the two of them, that isn't going to necessarily make it.
They're both very good. They're both very good in the film, and I rate them both as actors. James McAvoy, it was the first film I saw him in,
right,
as I recall, and I rated him from then, and I've seen a few things with him since then, and I still rate him as an actor. So I recommend Last King of Scotland. I saw it in the cinema when it first came out, and I really enjoyed it.
Good.
So if you haven't seen it, that's one I definitely recommend.
I have, and like yourself, it's been quite a while since I have seen it, and I do remember impressing particularly on the factor of the performances by the two principals, because they are great, and the plot I think could very easily have failed without having those two in it,
because it is very focused on their performances and how they pull it off.
It's a very odd plot, you know, in a way. Obviously it is actually based upon some amount of reality, but it's not one you would automatically think that you could easily turn into a film without having
it's
the strength
not got Hollywood
of
material printed all over it, has it really?
Joe?
Good morning, Vietnam.
You're not going to say it?
You're going to say it?
I'm not going to say it on my own.
Oh, right. No. Oh, you want me to do it with you?
Go on.
You can both do it.
Go on.
Okay.
You've made me go all pink now, stop it.
Good morning, Vietnam!
You even had the accent, well done.
Well, we tried.
Yeah.
We're very trying.
With the epic Robin Williams.
Yes.
One of my absolute favourites, directed by Barry Levinson. Robin Williams plays a DJ, Adrian Cronauer, who goes over to Vietnam to entertain the troops.
Yes.
And he is a bit of a loose cannon. And Forrest Whitaker again is in this one.
Yeah.
And plays Garlic, who is there to be his minder, make sure he doesn't get into any more trouble.
He doesn't do
his job very well, to be honest. He gets into a considerable amount of trouble. Robin Williams is absolutely fabulous.
It's held as one of, not only one of his more popular performances films, but also one of the more...
It's one of those that's held in cult following again, isn't
it? Yeah, but it's also it's one that's regarded as one that popularly shows the strength of his ability to act.
Mm. Yeah, he can do the comedy, and he was ad-libbing a lot of it.
Yeah.
And then it shows his serious, more sort of ability to his acting side. When there's when the restaurant gets blown up, there's a lot of puts a lot of emotion into it. So he does it extremely well. It keeps the Vietnam War, that obviously is the main subject.
It's the backdrop to it, of course, isn't it?
But it doesn't sensationalise it or anything like that. It's more about him and his character rather than what the war is about and who he's fighting.
It doesn't get into the actual battlefield as such. It's more about the lives of the GIs and particularly his role,
politics of it,
his role within the
I imagine it's probably one of the few films. I mean, I haven't seen it, but
you haven't seen it.
I haven't seen it. I'm going
to
be honest.
I was just about to say, I can't think of many people who haven't seen it. So if you haven't seen it,
I've seen bits and pieces of it here and there. But by the sounds of it, it sounds like one of the few films about Vietnam that's not guns and violence and the kind of thing
that
you would hate.
No, it's not blood and guts and gore. You do, absolutely. And there's lots and lots of quotes in there that you'll find yourself just...
Throw a few out.
Well,
it's 5 o'clock in the morning.
It's 0500.
0500. What does the O stand for? Oh my God,
it's
early.
It's an iconic role for Robin Williams, who had a plethora of iconic roles, really, when you think about it.
Oh, yeah.
And this is one of the ones that seem to have reached across the board and appealed to a lot of people. And there was quite a lot of people that
I've not seen it, but I know that quote from the star that I joined in with, and...
Well,
I know of the film.
It came out at a particular time in which there was the upturn in people having videos at home, and it was one of those ones that people got and then just watched incessantly, because there was so much in it that you could actually watch it repeatedly without it being a sort of getting tired. And that
it's
was
funny every time you watch
and,
it.
Yeah.
And because it. Yeah, because the performances of the funny is as important as what it actually is saying that
content,
is funny.
Yeah.
And as you say, a lot of it had been ad-libbed, and then him being able to do the pathos of the sadness and upset about what's actually going on around as well. It encompasses both sides of the emotions, and that's why I think I think it does actually appeal across the board, and that's why it's one of his most popular films. Right, to be honest.
It's quite a long film, actually. I seem to remember it being quite a long film, wasn't it? Oh, yeah, two hours, just one minute. But it doesn't feel like that as you watch it. It's not one of those you sit there thinking, oh, this could have finished half an hour ago.
It doesn't waste screen time, does it?
Absolutely not.
It uses...
I think anything with Robin Williams in it's...
There's a couple of exceptions that we spoke about, but this fills into the same category really as things like Back to the Future and Ghostbusters, where there's not any wasted pieces of dialogue or scene.
Right.
They don't have filler in there. They take every opportunity to make it mean something.
Right.
It's not like it's meaning something in a way that's ramming down your throat. It's in a way that's sometimes subtle, and that's why they're
complementing to the plot, nonetheless. Yeah,
and that's why the rewatches you'll pick up an extra bit next time. I mean, you know, I've said it before with things like Shaun of the Dead and things where you can watch that again and again and again and pick up extra elements, and you can with Ghostbusters and Back to the Future and numerous other films. They're littered with so much detail and making use of every single moment they have and every single word that's being said, they're making use of, and this is the same, and obviously the talent of performance in there as well.
Can't believe you've got to your age and you've not seen it.
Yeah, no. I was astounded by that as well.
Yeah.
Bits and pieces of it, but
you definitely have to watch it. I'm not sure if I've got it on DVD actually.
I thought I did have, but I'll have to look at the end.
I think I've got it on video.
I thought I had it on DVD, but it might be somebody who borrowed it. But so. Yeah, that's one that you definitely need to actually.
I definitely need to. So you would recommend it then, would you?
Yeah.
Gee, thanks.
I would definitely say you need to hunt it down and make sure you have seen it, because it's a major gap you need to.
But don't watch it with anybody who's seen it before, because they'll just read it, they'll say the lines before.
It's one of those.
You can't help yourself doing it, and it's one of the most annoying things in the world to sit with somebody who's doing that.
Yes, it is.
Right, so we'll move on to my next one,
which is
a darker film in tone, and that is Chinatown.
Oh, Jack Nicholson.
Jack Nicholson, yep. Yes.
The Roman Polanski film.
That's it, from 1974, also starring Faye Dunaway and John Huston. It's very much a film noir thriller.
Or inspired by film noir, I suppose, because it's made...
But done in the 70s, so it's got that extra grittiness to it that you didn't get in the originals.
Yeah.
But it's got the gumshoe-style detective and the twisting plot of there being set-ups and double crosses and etc. And it's set before the Second World War around the building of new water amenities in Los Angeles. But
very much a detective style.
It is, because there's the murder, mystery, mistaken identity...
Right.
And it's got a very iconic sense to it. There's a lot of scenes in it that just stand out. And I mean, you probably have seen Jack Nicholson with the big plasters across his nose that he gets partway through. And that is a very much dramatic scene when you see that one played out, the realness of it, because he actually pretty much did do it really and just stopped short just of actually cutting his nose properly in the way they did it. And when you consider how much they did that real rather than with effects, it was quite striking. It's, you can tell that that's probably why Roman Polanski decided to be the person doing the cut himself, being the opposing guy, because if it had gone wrong, he wouldn't have somebody else to blame. Nobody else was willing to take the risk, maybe, with Jack Nicholson's face.
It's an expensive face.
But it does very much play upon the themes of somebody who is initially quite cocky and then gets out of their depth and struggles and spiral out of control of what's going on. And Jack Nicholson plays that part perfectly, I feel.
I've always rated him as an actor.
He just does that very well. I mean, I know in more recent times there's people like DiCaprio who can do that as well, where they can play cocky but also play like a complete mess with no control and falling apart. You know, a lot of actors can only do one side of that and not both, but Nicholson really does embody this part. Does it incredibly. It's one of his great roles. Faye Dunaway, looks beautiful in it, and actually does play the role incredibly well as well in this. It's very gritty but iconic, and to be honest, it's the strength of the writing and the performances do actually very much befit it being as respected as it is, even though it's not necessarily known by your casual cinema watcher.
It's not one of those that just rolls off the tongue when you think of detective film or sort of, I suppose, crime thriller films or mysteries.
That's it, yeah.
But It's one of those I know of.
Not for
it's
everybody, I suppose, there in the back of the mind, but it's a very strong example of what it is, to be honest.
There's always this thing with like your mysteries and things where you can watch it and feel like it's just trying too hard when it's throwing you one curveball after another after another.
Yeah, the twists and turns in this don't seem to be there for the sake of it.
Yeah.
They're intrinsic to the plot and actually come across naturally rather than it being some of the more recent years, some of the M. Night Shyamalan stuff where initially there was more subtlety to what he did and then other people were copying that and even him became a kind of parody of himself. Yeah. And then the twists were just, it was almost like the British TV. You might not remember being younger, but the British TV series, which was Tales of the Unexpected, where you get these stories that go along for half an hour, and then right at the end there'd be something completely bizarre out that had just from the left field.
It's just there for shock value, wasn't it?
Whoa, and suddenly they'd open the door and there'd be a monster there for no reason, or, you know, all this kind of stuff, and you just go, what, eh? And unfortunately, a lot of films did get more into that, I think, of having twists in there just for the sake of it, rather than it being actually
meditated and well thought through.
Well, that's it. It being intrinsic to the plot and actually being methodically done.
Mm.
And this death very much has that it's done with style.
Yeah.
So I definitely recommend it to somebody who doesn't have an aversion to that kind of film, because it is a great example of that kind of film.
I'll check out as well.
Yeah.
My movie list is growing all the time.
Good. So, Alistair, your next one?
My next film is 7 Years in Tibet, Brad Pitt film. Made, late 90s, 1997 actually. Jean-Jacques Arnaud, director. I personally very much enjoyed this film. Brad Pitt plays Heinrich Harrer, an Austrian mountain climber, a bit of a celebrity in the beginning of the film.
Right.
And as the film kicks off, it's sort of in the lead up to the Second World War, Germany's Third Reich is sort of coming to power and so on.
Who was the leader of the Third Reich?
some funny joke.
Some fella with a mustache, I think.
Charlie Chaplin.
Chaplin,
that was it. Anyway, kick off of the film, Heinrich Harrer, Brad Pitt's character, leads an expedition that's going to go and try and conquer Everest.
Right.
As they sort of begin their climb, they get to about sort of base camp when the Second World War kicks off and they all become prisoners of war.
Right.
Taken to a British concentration camp. The next bit of the film involves Pitt's character trying to escape this, not concentration camp, but prisoner of war camp,
yeah,
and sort of escape across the border into Tibet, which he eventually manages to do, even though the borders are closed to foreigners at that point. The main body of the film sort of follows from there when he comes into contact with the young Dalai Lama and becomes something of a sort of tutor/father-like figure to the young Dalai Lama. Yeah, a mentor kind of figure, telling him all about the outside world and sort of showing him things that he's never seen.
Right.
And so it becomes this, a bit of a sort of clash of cultures where at first you feel like almost Heinrich Harrer, sort of Brad Pitt's character, is going to sort of impose Westernism and bring all his ideas sort of into Tibet, this sort of old world nation that's all temples and religion and so on.
Yeah.
But as it goes on, his character sort of starts to appreciate that more and sort of takes it on board.
So less a clash, more of a meeting.
Yeah, more of a meeting, but if it was done in a different way, it could almost feel like it was going to clash. But
right.
But I felt that was worked fairly well. One of my favourite moments in the film is Brad Pitt's character's talking to the young Dalai Lama, and he says, there's something along the lines of when he's being asked by the young Dalai Lama why he climbs mountains, because it's not something they do in Tibet. He says, because there's only two times in my life when I've truly felt alive, when I'm climbing mountains and when I'm in your presence, he says to the young Dalai Lama, referring to his wisdom and everything he's sort of learnt as he's taken on board this culture. So I really enjoyed it. It's quite a long film, I think nearly about 2.5 hours, something like that, I think.
Right.
At times it feels like it drags through certain scenes, but other times it feels like it uses it to sort of the time quite well. It's not like an awful lot of other films I've seen, but I really enjoyed it, as I've said.
So. Is Brad Pitt good in it? Because he's...
I think he is. I enjoyed him in it, and that's pretty rare for Brad Pitt films for me.
Really? I quite like
it. I'm not a massive fan of his, but
I think I like more mainstream films, to be honest.
I suppose I can stand in some aspects of it dragging points because of obviously it being over a 7-year period.
Yeah,
so that, you know, you can't expect it to be constantly there being something happening. Yeah, so I suppose there must be some moments when things are happening slower than other times.
Yeah, it's one of those films. It's kind of like almost a historical biopic or something, but done through the sort of the eyes of this Australian climber that gets sort of dragged into the middle of it all and just sort of journeys through it all. And it is based on historical fact, because Henry Carrer is an actual person who went on to become a lifelong friend of the Dalai Lama and died a few years ago, I believe. Right. So.
Well, I mean, as I say, Brad Pitt, I think, can do some great performances.
I think that's one of them.
And again, like I said before, it's one of those, like Ewan McGregor, where he needs to be given the right material to work in the right direction, and he can be quite lightweight and useless in some things, I think, and when in other things he can actually be quite strong in his performance, and it just depends on what material he's given to work with, really. Yeah. So,
yes.
What's your next one, then?
Madagascar,
of course, yeah.
Yay, Madagascar.
The animated children's...
Film. We don't call them children's films. Yeah. Family films.
Yeah. It's about four animals in the New York Zoo who escape and end up in Madagascar, funnily enough.
You're going to say South Africa for a minute there.
Marty the lion, who is played by Chris Rock. No, it's not. Marty's the zebra. Alex the Lion is played by Ben Stiller, and David Schwimmer is Melman the giraffe, and Jada Pinkett Smith is Gloria the hippo, and she's got lots and lots of attitude.
Yes, she does. Kind of matriarchal figure, sort of, isn't she? Yeah. She's full of sass.
But they end up escaping from the zoo with the aid of penguins.
Of course.
And these penguins are the sort of the comedy aspect, I think, of the film. They have lots of funny lines. And they all end up in Madagascar. And it's about how they cope with being in the wild and the characters that they meet whilst they're in Madagascar and their journey to try and get out of Madagascar.
And they realise they don't like it.
Yeah. There's lots and lots of jokes in there that adults will appreciate, as well as, you know, it being the target audience is mainly children, but you can certainly sit there as an adult and watch it.
There are a lot of characters as well, like the Lemur King is...
Lemur King, who's very camp.
Yes.
He's played by Sacha Baron Cohen. He kind of steals the film, I think. He should have a show of his own.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Again, it's kind of... There's three of them in the series, and they progressively get worse. Madagascar 3 is a circus-based film. Mm.
Good example of things to do by any chance.
A good example of diminishing returns, then.
Mm. Yeah. First one, great. Second one, all right. Third one, I really wouldn't bother.
And then isn't there a spin-off?
The Penguins of Madagascar.
Which I've heard is actually very good.
It is.
Comparable to the sequels of...
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I mean, they're DreamWorks, aren't they, Madagascar, I think, so... They're usually...
But it's good to know that it falls into the category of these family animated films where there's actually... It does have something for all of the family, because...
Oh, yeah, definitely.
The Pixar ones often do that.
Yeah. I think the DreamWorks are just sort of just below Pixar in that regard. I think they're the sort of...
Yeah. I mean, we, you know...
They play second fiddle, but they do the whole family appeal quite well, and I think Madagascar's one that pulls it off.
This is one, you know, Saturday afternoon, it's raining, pop the popcorn, sit down in front of it with the kids. That's cool. I enjoyed that one.
So, my next one is Once Upon a Time in Mexico.
Oh, yes!
From 2003.
That's also on my list.
Oh, that's good.
It's not on mine.
It's not on yours, no.
It's your kind of film, Joe, I'm going to be honest.
Directed by Robert Rodriguez. Starring Antonio Banderas, Salma Hayek, Johnny Depp, William Dafoe, Mickey Rourke, Eva Mendes, and Danny Trejo, and Cheech Marin.
Did you say Johnny Depp was in it?
Yeah.
I'm suddenly interested.
No. It is the third one in a series, and actually does perform well as part of the trilogy, and is a good film in its own right, not necessarily diminishing returns in the same way that you have with many films.
I think it's kind of the most famous of the three, really.
It is. I mean,
what are the three?
It's El Mariachi and Desperado, and then Once Upon a Time in Mexico. I think I actually prefer Desperado out of the three, but that's not to diminish Once Upon a Time in Mexico. I think it does have...
I mean, it's on my list, but that's not to say it's my favourite film.
No, no.
It wouldn't be on my top seven favourite films of all time, I'd say.
It's a stylish actioner, very much set within the exploitation type genre. And although it doesn't completely throw itself into the exploitation, it does actually have strong elements of that.
Mm.
And it's very much style as a film.
Yeah, of course.
And although it's got good performances from the people in it, what they're required to do is very stylized. So it's not stretching them in the same way you would expect for them doing some other performances elsewhere. But it is a fun film to watch. It's, you know, lots of explosions and stunts that have them performing strange ways in which to actually be having gun battles with each other and, you know, almost acrobatics. And you know,
so this is one I would fall asleep.
And it's got the
guns in guitar cases
and actually a gun that is a guitar as well.
Yeah.
A pump action shotgun, I seem to remember,
the neck of a guitar.
It does unfold quite well and within its own stylized genre, I would say, and it might not be for everybody, Joe, but
it's got Johnny Depp in it.
Yeah, so you might find it enough in that respect. But as I say, it's very much an actioner, and it's not requiring you to engage too much of your brain, so it's quite easy to.
Or any just about.
Any brain.
So I might be able to watch it.
So you might be able to. And you've got to take it into account that the violence level in it is actually so stylized and over the top that it's not.
Yeah,
it's
not horror,
it's
is it?
Not it's not in the way of horror. It's
cool violence.
It is done with the style in mind rather than the gruesomeness in mind. That's a film that I could recommend people to watch if they want something that's not going to tax them much with their brain. And it does have some, you know, witty one-liners here and there and bits and pieces. So
it's well worth a watch.
It is if you don't have an aversion to that mindless type of film. To that mindless, styled actioner. Yes. So, Alistair, your next one?
My next one, Hotel Rwanda.
Right.
Next on my list. It's a pretty heavy movie, I'm going to be honest. I mean, if you have an aversion to very, I'd say, historically accurate, very dramatic and almost horrifying films.
Well, it's quite
It's very heavy subject matter.
It is quite a dark part of human history, isn't it, really?
It is, revolving around the sort of the
genocide.
Hutu military, the sort of Rwandan war and the genocide that followed, and it's heavy stuff. My director Terry George stars Don Cheadle, who's very good in it as
the Iron Patriot.
not quite. Slightly different role.
It would have been a very different type of film if he'd had that suit, I think.
Yes, it might have turned out a little differently. But he plays Paul, who's a hotel manager. He's running a fairly high-class hotel in Rwanda at the time of the military uprising and the civil war that begins, and as sort of refugees start being forced onto the streets, he starts taking them in and sort of hiding them in the back. He turns his little hotel into a kind of oasis in the storm sort of thing. And so all the while he's trying to protect his family, who are of mixed backgrounds, so obviously with the genocide going on, there's danger there. He's got all the refugees, that's what I was looking for. He's trying to look after those, and at the same time he's trying to run his business as a reputable hotel as well. So it's,
he's got a mixture of story threads in there, then, I suppose.
It's not just
about one subject matter or another. Yeah. There's a couple of different areas within the story. Yeah.
But Don Cheadle's character becomes a kind of a figure of strength within the film, as he sort of has to be, because there's an awful lot riding on him by the end. And
do you see much of the horror that sort of went on?
Because
that's why I wouldn't want to watch it.
Not really. I mean, I believe it's a 12A, I think. Yeah. So there's not a lot of violence and gore, but it doesn't dodge around the actual subject matter. It is there in the background. You're aware of it if you know about it.
But it's not sort of shoved in your face.
It's not shoved in your face, no. Right. But if you know the background to it and you know what it's referring to, you can't sort of dodge away from it watching the film.
Is it more portraying the horrific repercussions of the violence that was perpetrated by the two sides against each other rather than actually portraying the violence against? Is that the case?
It doesn't
show people being macheted to death. It shows the after effect of the horror that causes on people.
The horror it causes on people, on the refugees, on the people who live there, rather than focusing on two militaries firing at one another and killing one another. But as I say, it is quite a heavy film. It's I imagine it's very good. The acting is excellent, and it doesn't suffer terribly from the sort of Hollywoodization, I suppose, of sort of making up historical facts. I mean, it's got the sort of fictional storyline with the hotel and the actual characters and everything, but I felt it didn't sort of sensationalise or downplay what happened, because it's quite a big and rather horrific thing that happened. So
absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's a dark moment in history, particularly in more recent times, that, you know, we hoped that we were beyond genocides after the Second World War, and then it goes and happens.
I think it's important that films like this do get made and they do get watched, though, so that we don't forget that these things have happened. We have done these things to one another.
Yeah.
And so it's important to have films like this, even if they aren't a lot of fun to watch, even if they aren't easy to watch. I think it's still good to have those films there.
You
that
have to be in the right mood to watch it, then.
Yeah.
Most definitely do, yeah. I think it's an excellent film, and I recommend watching it if you're of the sort of mindset.
Okay. So my next one is The Outlaw Josie Wales.
Another one that's on my list, Thief.
Yeah, good taste and all that, or Simple Minds, Simple Thoughts,
Simple
I don't know.
Simple Minds Think Alike, that's wrong, I'm sure it is.
Possibly, yeah. So from 1976, which was really at the tail end of the people's
spaghetti western
happiness
sort of
with, yeah, I think the appetite for westerns had waned by that point.
Waned, John Wayne. Westerns, yeah. That's not what you did there.
Yes, it's directed by Clint Eastwood and starring Clint Eastwood along with his then partner Sandra Locke, who went on to star in a number of films with him.
Was that one of the first?
Well, they were living together, they weren't. I don't think they ever got married.
Was it one of the first that you directed and starred?
Yes, it was. You're right there, yeah.
Because, I mean, obviously now he does a lot of that, you know, he does everything, like.
He tends to only star in things he's actually directing now.
Like Gran Torino.
Gran Torino, Million Dollar Baby, Trouble with a Curve.
Starred.
Sang the theme
tune.
Yeah.
I wrote the theme tune.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's very much a gritty revenge western with some commentary about the
Surely not with Clint Eastwood.
Exactly, yeah.
Revenge?
No. With some commentary about war. I mean, it's.
What's it good for? Absolutely nothing.
He's from the Confederate side during the American Civil War.
Yeah.
Who then is, he's then actually double-crossed his whole unit, and he doesn't surrender like some of the rest of them do, and so he ends up being an outlaw in that sense, especially since the rest of them are then butchered and he survives.
He's got French blood then.
That's it.
Surrender.
So, and then he joins forces with some other people who are on the sort of fringes of society who have also been pushed out and attacked and victimised. And he ends up defending them and going on a bit on a revenge kick against the people who killed his family. And it's very well performed, but it is gritty, and it does have a lot of people talking in shadows and such like to actually have effect upon making you feel it's more mysterious and gritty and dark and things. And it works, and there's plenty of what you would expect from Clint Eastwood Western with gunfighting and horses being ridden round in circles and people chasing each other and such.
All that
like
kind of thing,
It, it all plays out well with that, and it does have the pathos that it actually looks for generally as far as portraying characters that had done by that actually victims of circumstance and those in worse-off positions been taken advantage of by the powers that be and such. And it's all all within there, as you would expect.
I suppose in that way it's a sort of it's one of those subjects that I haven't seen touched upon too much in westerns of what happens sort of after the sort of
after the Civil War. I think it's more one that was a bridge between that tail end of the public's fascination with westerns and then the more modern versions of westerns, which have actually managed to portray the West at that time as being gritty and the damage that was done to certain people and stuff, having it all just been ranchers and
John Wayne on the wagon trail.
That's it. It all been a bit idealised.
It's all a bit sort of grown up from then, hasn't it?
Whereas this, actually injected a bit of more reality in it in that sense, and this did that, and he continued to with Pearl Rider and such like doing bits of that. But I think there is some crossover between this and some of the Dirty Harry things that he was doing, where it was actually bringing in the elements of the victim's story, as it were.
Yeah.
Which I think happened in some of those films. So in that sense, it's a move on from the spaghetti westerns and more characterisation of the spaghetti westerns, but still it is the tail end of that genre.
Yeah.
So it would be more something for fans of those westerns.
Yeah, which in themselves are all excellent films. Yeah. I mean, the Dollars Trilogy is a fantastic series of films.
Absolutely. Your next one? A final one?
Yeah. I had Madagascar on my list.
Right. So that brings us to the end of our list then. Well done. So I shall just move us on to some of the submissions that we had from the listeners.
Yes.
We had...
all the ones we should have got and didn't.
Well, I had a number of also-rans on my list.
Such as?
Well, I'll mention the ones that have been submitted by the listeners, and then I'll fill in the gaps that they didn't choose themselves. For Wilbrow Jr. on Twitter, who's Dave, who's a regular listener to the show, he chose Madagascar. Brazil. The Prince of Egypt. Good Morning Vietnam, From Russia We Love, Congo, and Once Upon a Time in Mexico.
From Russia We Love, I should have got that one.
Have you heard the Yorkshire remake of Prince of Egypt?
Prince of T-Egypt.
T-Egypt.
Prince of T-Egypt, jeez.
I made myself blush with how crap that joke was.
You've been hanging around with me too long. You've been hanging around with me too long. That's, you've been infected in that way. And we also had a mail from Scott from Married with Clickers. He says, I thought I'd send you a note telling you how much I enjoy your show. I'm a fan as I enjoy your casual yet informed conversations.
Mm-hmm.
I think Cinematic Sevens is a really fun idea, and I thought I'd share my list. So he says, a disclaimer first.
Uh-oh.
5 minutes of thought went into this, so I've probably forgotten some great films. So we shall see. His number seven is Hotel Rwanda, which he says is heartbreaking stuff. Like all historical fiction, certain the facts are not 100% accurately presented, but I'm also certain I 100% don't care. And then his next one, number six, was Last King of Scotland.
Or middle one on mine.
So I said, see above, I'll assume you'll allow countries within the UK to qualify. And we certainly will.
Mm-hmm, I hope so.
Number five, he said, Brazil, my choices. So Way Too Young was 13 or 14 when it was in the theatres. Didn't understand it, not sure I do today. Which I think is a fair comment.
Yeah.
Number four on his list was Jamaica Inn.
It's based on the
book. Charles Laughton and Alfred Hitchcock together. Although he does say not the best work from either of them, but still two formidable gentlemen.
Mm.
My lovely wife recommended I read the Daphne du Maurier book when we started dating, and I was pleasantly surprised. So, and number three was Madagascar 3.
Ooh. When you said it was the worst of the bunch.
He said, I took my kids to see this in 3D. There's a jaw-dropping moment when the circus performances click, a true cinematic blend of images and music. Katy Perry, to be perfectly honest, that we all shared. It was movie magic. Actually, I always have a soft spot for this one, as it was the first experience like that with my children.
I do agree about the Katy Perry thing. It's the fireworks song. I must admit, that is
quite a highlight of an otherwise.
That bit and the final credits were the
difference is he saw it in 3D. Must be what you're missing.
Do you know what? It must be.
Yeah.
It didn't leap out to you.
No.
So, his number two, then, is High Road to China. He said China might win the award for the most options.
Mm.
An old-fashioned Tom Selleck adventure flick in theatres as a child. I dug it. It's not that bad as far as a consolation prize for not being Indiana Jones. So, which I think is a fair comment. And his final one is From Russia With Love. Connery versus Shaw. Can it get any more macho? Anyway, that's it. I look forward to your list. Keep up the good work. I'll be listening. Stay gold, Scott. So
nice for him.
That's he does present. Him and his lovely wife Kat do present a very good show themselves, Married with Clickers, which is worth listening to, in my opinion. Mm. I'm still playing catch up because they do have a lot of episodes out there, and I'm slowly catching up on them, but haven't quite got there yet. So. So the other ones that I had on my also-ran list were...
I've had a few also-rans.
This is England.
Yeah, that was on my also-rans.
From Russia We Love.
Totally forgot it existed.
Made in Britain. Passage to India. Australia, which isn't a good film. Baz Luhrmann's...
That was on TV the other night,
actually. Shit. Congo. Which I haven't actually seen, but I don't believe it's got a very good reputation for itself.
I've heard some stories about some yucky bits in that.
Boys from Brazil, which is a old film about Nazi hunting, and is quite a good film, in my opinion. China Syndrome, Hotel Rwanda, 7 Years in Tibet that you said, Sam Fisher, mm-hmm. Prince, of Egypt. And then we also decided to create some titles that weren't actually real films, yes, but were actually injecting country names into a title of a film. So,
without further ado,
Congo in the Distance and the Greenland Mile.
Oh yeah, Sliding Ecuadors and Yugoslavia Got Mail.
Oh, Catch Me If You Canada. X-Files, I Want to Belize.
Ah, yes. Marley and Me, Spain and Gain.
Marley spelled...
As in the country, yeah. India Heat of the Night.
Oh, yes.
The Legend of Bag of France.
A Fish Called Rwanda. And Hard Say.
Denmark of Zorro. Russia Hour.
Russia Hour, yeah.
Norway Out. Shutter Island. And 12 Angry Yemen.
Oh, just sigh.
Yes. Painful, aren't they? It is painful, yes. Painful. And we plan on doing that next time if people want to contribute either proper films or films where they've actually forced it into being on the theme, then we're happy to have lists of either or both. The next theme I have decided will be weather. So it has to have some weather feature within the title of the film. So an obvious one, which I shall throw out there, is Rain Man.
Yep.
So if we can have the contributions from listeners for that.
About Sharknado. Sore point.
I think that's one that fits into the forced comedy ones at the end, really. I think they came up with that
first.
Yeah,
but they did that for us.
I think then they made it into a film, so they didn't realise it was actually somebody's joke. In fact, I think that's how the films came about, wasn't it? Wasn't it a group of writers sat around and they came up with that, and they came up with...
Sharknado 2.
The Snakes on a Plane, where they got stupid titles and then decided to create a film.
What's
Sharktopus as well.
I wouldn't know Sharktopus, yes. So yes, if we can have the listener contributions for that, please, to our HOM podcast Twitter account, hashtagged Cinematic7s, with the word 7 spelled out rather than just the number, that would be great. I look forward to reading those. So please join us next time, and I'd like to thank Alistair and Joe for joining me on this and putting up with the pain of my so-called humour.
Made it through.
Don't fall down.
I don't think so. Probably the listeners need to do as well. So, for me, it's goodbye.
Bye.
See ya.
Then we also had a mail from Scott from Married With Children's, who said, "Hi fellas, I thought I'd send you a note telling you how much I enjoy your show. I'm a big fan as I really enjoy your casual yet informed conversation." So I'm not sure that's actually gone to the right people, this email.
Yeah.
So,
I don't think you actually got his name right either when you said who it was.
Scott from Married With Clickers?
Yeah, you said Married With Children.
Yeah.
Just edit that out, it's fine.
He says,
"Watch a crap American sitcom, Married with Children."